Good morning. There's always a crisis for me. I get so nervous sitting up here, I have to tell myself over and over again a story that Ajahn Sumedho tells about himself. When he was a very young monk in Thailand, in a monastery with Ajahn Chah, in which there were many, many monks who'd been there 10, 20, 30 years. Ajahn Chah would love to say to Sumedho, I'd like you to give the Dhamma talk tonight on Four Noble Truths, and just to be sure you're able to cover everything that you know about them, you can talk until tomorrow morning. And inevitably all the monks would fall asleep. He'd go through all kinds of fearful things about, I have to be entertaining, I have to be brilliant. And it would all get burned up because there was nothing left in the end. So I find this story very comforting. I just came back from a retreat at IMS, and I came to some understandings for the first time, which I always then say, "Hey, what took you so long? You know, this is so obvious." But I wanted to share those in a way that would not. I don't want to imply that it's the same for all of us, and yet in some strange way. What I'm pointing toward is that there is a sameness for all of us. If we hold ourselves to be unique individuals, there's something about this practice that breaks down that idea we have about ourselves as being special. One of my favorite guidance is an old saying that if you want to learn how your mind works, sit down and watch it. And I think the wonderful thing about retreats, for those of you who haven't done them, is that a container is established where you don't have to do anything in the way of worldly tasks except just decide whether you're going to sit or walk now. Everything else is taken care of. And then you get to watch your mind in the absence of tasks and watch what it does. And you have the opportunity to basically sit and walk in as continuous a fashion as you can. So there seems to be a very important aspect of practice, which is that idea of continuous mindfulness, which if we are able to, we could bring this into our lives and be mindful every moment of our lives. That's hopefully what we're pointing towards, but it's very hard, as we know. We get caught, constantly caught in external stuff, and we forget to pay attention to what's going on for ourselves. But that is the objective of this practice. Can we do this continuously every moment of our lives? And in the retreat setting, you have the opportunity, by simplifying everything down to bare bones, to actually try to do that. And it's a very powerful thing, because what happens over time is, this is my experience, and I think it's really quite universal experience, is that you gradually quiet down, and your mind stops chattering continuously. It still chatters, but not continuously. Your body, along with your mind, quiets down. And you start to be able to see, in the relative simplicity of that, what's the habitual patterns of your own mind. It's pretty discouraging, actually, but as an example, for myself, I have kind of three ruts that my mind likes to run in on retreat when it doesn't have anything else to do. Some of these are entertaining, and some of these are very painful, but I'll explain them in a second. But what happens when you quiet down is you start to be able to see that your mind and your body are intimately related. There's really no thinking that goes on without manifestations in the body in the form of tensions. In my own experience for myself, as soon as I start thinking, I realize I have a mild headache. Just takes a couple of moments of thinking. And then I have a very mild headache behind my eyes and between my temples. Happens every time. If I really get caught and really think, I get terribly caught in one of my own stories, which I'm certainly prone to do, particularly they have lots of elements of self-righteousness, of being right, holding to opinions with all kinds of extra stuff on them. I get an absolutely splitting headache, and I can even make myself nauseated just sitting here like this with my eyes closed. So I get to see over and over again that I can actually make myself sick by what I think about, if I choose to do that. So there's an assignment for myself. Can I not do that? So the places that my mind likes to run, because I need to get specific about this so I can talk about them, are if on retreat, if I'm getting bored, what I tend to do is bring up my old home movies. Some of them are quite entertaining, especially the ones about sexual fantasies, sexual memories. And then there's some that are not very entertaining, things that I've done in my life that were unskillful. Those memories, working through those again and again. Why did I do that? What didn't I understand? What don't I understand about that? Then there's an activity that I do of planning, lots and lots of planning. I'm really, really silly planning. I'm planning about things I'm going to do after I get out of the retreat, even though I may not even be alive then, or I certainly won't be the person that I am now on retreat. And yet I'm making these plans all the time, and they're fear-based plans, I've come to realize. They're based on trying to get it perfect all the time. And if I plan it over and over again, I may actually be able to do it perfectly. Even though, of course, when I'm doing the plan, I don't actually know the conditions that will be unfolding when I'm doing that thing later. So it's really, really silly behavior, and yet I'm doing it a lot. And then the third activity that I really like to do, but I find very painful, is the judging, comparing mind's activities. For example, you know, see somebody in the hall who drops a spoon and begin to think, boy, they're really out of it, you know. And then immediately the mind recoils and judges myself, and just back and forth, just being reborn every moment or two into some new experience, some new memory, some new personality, over and over and over again. There's a place I like to walk at IMS, which is a very dark basement area, so there's not a lot of stimulus down there. And in walking the length of the room, and maybe about this distance in 10 minutes, I can live half a dozen lives. One moment full of self-grandiosity, the next moment full of self-criticism, the next moment planning something. I mean, just watch yourself be reborn over and over again. And And every one of those moments, there's suffering of some kind or another, if you pay attention. It's very unpleasant. And never in those rebirths are you in the present moment. Perhaps between the rebirths, when you're actually being mindful, you can be in the present moment. But the rest of the time, I'm being pulled to the past or pulled to the future, and it's not pleasant. What I want to share in terms of that general picture, which I confess to experiencing on every retreat that I go on, I really experience it in my daily life on an ongoing basis, except that I'm so busy doing stuff, I'm not noticing that I'm doing that so much. But there is this idea, that's talked about in karma of conditioning your rebirth, of the events of your life setting the conditions for the conditions of rebirth. And I realized that I could apply that to these habits of mind. I began to think, you know, if I can actually stop myself when I start thinking about some particular thing, and I'll pick the example of personal memories. If I will actually not keep indulging in that, I can decondition my rebirth into that same kind of life again. I can perhaps change that mental habit and replace it with something more wholesome. So on this retreat, I set about to do that, and I targeted one particular of these three ruts, which is this personal memory thing. And I kind of, even though the whole process of getting caught in thought is a mindless one, not a mindful one, somehow I was able to put up a little road sign that said, "Don't go down this way." And it would pop up quite quickly as I worked at it. I got more and more quick at intercepting myself as I would start to turn down that road toward personal memories. And I would just, if I caught myself really early, I would just say, "Not now, just not now, just back to the mindfulness." If I had been fully caught, so I was well down that road, and I needed to back up to get off that road, disengage myself, there's a technique that the Burmese teach, which is taught at IMS, that you just put your mindfulness on the accompanying physical sensations that have gone with that thought. And if, in the example I used, if there's nausea or headache, you just put your full attention on those sensations and watch them mindfully as they disappear. And somehow there's a deconditioning in that. I cannot explain that, but there is. You actually start to decondition yourself from going down that road. So I found myself able to, over the retreat, actually not do personal memories anymore. Now, I'm not pretending that this is for the rest of my life, but for the time of the retreat, I was actually able to eliminate that activity, and using metta practice, cultivating positive states of mind, began to replace these afflictive thinking patterns with metta, with compassion, so that we actually have an option here, you know? And I was thrilled by it. Of course, there's one part of me that says, "What took you so long?" But nonetheless, I commend it. I commend it to your consideration. The other area I'd like to talk about is other things that come up in the practice that's accessible in our daily practice in the same way that, but it's just more so on retreat, is the actual possible in just our daily sitting practice to actually observe the three characteristics that the Buddha points to, of anicca, impermanence, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness of life, and anatta, or which I would like to say is perhaps the insubstantiality of self. If you in the mindfulness of paying attention each moment to what's going on and being able to achieve some kind of acceptance or equanimity in that, kind of keep track of what is going on in your mind over a period of time, for example, just in the very simple example of breathing, that in the breathing process, in one inhalation, there is a constant changing set of sensations that are different in their sequence, and also the exhalation, sensations are different, and then they are different. One can see they're different between every single inhalation, and they're different between every single exhalation. There is this immediate access to the realization of impermanence, in that there is nothing repeating in any of these sensations. And the same is true of every observable phenomena. You can see it in walking, you can see it in the sensations in your body, there is nothing substantial to it. And yet we have this enormous need to have things be permanent. But it's just, it's not possible. And you can see it in your own daily sitting. Just watch it. And I lost my place here for a second. In the area of sense of impermanence of anicca. The second characteristic of dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of things, the sense that that in the mind's thinking, there is always an aspect of either craving or aversion or delusion, and there's also the if you look at the quality of your thinking is, in my experience at least, is always self-referencing, self-enhancing. It's every story that I have, every opinion I have, everything that my mind thinks about has an aspect of it that's about reinforcing my ego, reconstructing my ego over and over and over again. It's almost like a computer memory that has to be refreshed on an ongoing, constant basis. And yet these stories, the self that I'm reconstructing in these stories is so completely transient, so changing. its characteristics in every single one of these memories. In one memory, I'm this wonderful person. The next memory, I'm a terrible person. The stories just go on and on, and yet, so I'm creating all of these stories in which I, the self, am constantly changing, and then I come to find out that that's what everyone does. So there's nothing here that's at all worth standing on. It's very empty. So in summary, there's something, this simple practice that we have has a very subversive nature to it, which it basically deconstructs these ideas that we have about ourselves that we hold so dearly. And yet in that deconstruction, there's a great deal of peace. So I'd like to open it up for any questions. Yes.
I was interested by your first time. I want to thank you for a very personal talk. A lot of times you get Buddhist psychology, and it's nice to hear your story. When you were sitting at IMS and you were working on getting that rut smoothed out, you know, sort of working on that, and you came to that place where you either started to see you were falling into it, or you found yourself in it. And when you said that, essentially you filled that place with metta, you know, or you redirected or inclined the mind towards more wholesome habit. When you were sitting in your practice, did you actually at that moment do metta during the retreat? And essentially, you know, inserting a different habit, in a sense. It's just a personal question. Instead of, you know, like, okay, we're doing Vipassana, but, you know, and for your practice, during that practice, is that what you did at that point? In that moment?
Yeah, I did, actually, because one of the things that would, in my own habits of mind, what would happen would be when I would catch myself well caught up in the thought, there would be a certain amount of self-recrimination that would immediately, my mind would immediately go toward, you know, you jerk, you promised you weren't going to do that, kind of a train of thought. And so, I have this sense that the mind sets up these kind of reverberations that are very strongly polarized if you let yourself get into that kind of place. So, as soon as the negative self-judgment would start to come up around having been caught, I would immediately go to metta practice for myself. And I found over time that inclination towards self-recriminating judgment would ease. And at the same time, I think this is speculation, but along with that came less tendency to get caught. So I was doing the metta in an effort to. I didn't really do it with the idea I was going to replace that particular rut of thinking activity with metta, but I did it more to stop this kind of self-recrimination that was going on. And over time, I found that the quickness with which I would put metta into the situation increased. So I was actually, I did seem to be with. Although it was not my plan, I was replacing now with a habit of mind which is more wholesome. Yes, Jim.
Also, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I was wondering if you've noticed a difference in these physical sensations when thought is occurring between when you've kind of passively moved into thinking and when you may have consciously chose to engage in thinking for some particular task or something. You know what I'm saying? Like if you,
yeah.
I mean, there's times when thinking is a useful tool. You get those same kinds of unpleasant sensations when you're engaged in that kind of thought.
I really can't answer that question. I don't know the answer. My sense is that this low-level headache that I talked about having as soon as I would start thinking, that is such a subtle headache that I think it's very hard to be aware of that in your normal life, because there's so many things going on, and then particularly if you're pointed toward a task where your mind is deliberately concentrating on something outside of yourself. It never even occurs to me to drop into that place and see if, in fact, I have a low-level headache there. I can't even. This question came up for me on retreat. There was one particular place I got caught two or three times on a retreat where I really got caught. I spent half an hour raging about something, and made myself once so nauseated I wasn't even sure I was going to be able to get out of the meditation hall without throwing up. And then immediately the question came up: if I'm in the outside world and I get caught like this, am I doing this to myself in the same way? Or is this a condition of being in a setting where I can actually continue to rage for a half an hour, 45 minutes uninterrupted, which is not actually a likely event in the outside world? Something will always come up. The light's going to turn green or whatever is going to happen, you know. So I don't know the answer to that question either, but I'm looking forward to finding out. I've never been aware of it before. So I don't really know the answer. Yes?
You mentioned toward the end of your talk about self, there's really nothing to stand on, because so much of it has to do with self-criticism or so many things you mentioned. In your experience, have you found that there is sort of a healthy self or a self that is uplifting or makes you feel good? Or is there a self? What is, and if so, what is that? Is that self? That, or is it a self even? Is it part of you?
I think you're pointing toward a very tricky area, which I will say a couple things about. There is language that's used that basically says that there's a relative level of reality where the self is an important concept, and there's an absolute level where there is no self. And in a lot of our lives, we have to function on that relative level. I mean, for example, just to take a trivial example, if I talk about going to the store, I'm clearly, I'm taking this assembly of stuff here, and I'm going to get in this metal thing outside, and I'm going to go to the store. That's a very useful concept, and it's because of its utility. My view is we've invested too much in that concept. There's an overinvestment in which we take that idea of self, which is useful at the relative level, and therefore imply that it is completely true at the absolute level. Meanwhile, there's this other set of realizations that are going on where you have all of these recognitions that there's a universality in all of these experiences, that these are common amongst all, at least all humankind, and maybe even all animal kind, about these stories that we construct, and that points toward a lack of uniqueness in self, at least. Now, I can imbue that self with all kinds of qualities. As a simple example from the previous question about doing metta for myself, if I say to here I am on a retreat looking at all of these ways in which there's no self, and then I say, may I be happy? And there's an immediate contradiction in that, obviously. And I became very concerned on the retreat. Am I reinforcing sense of self every time I give myself metta, or am I not? I don't know the answer to that question, but there is that difficulty there with using this I over and over and over again, particularly if you're doing it on a continuous basis. This word I starts to become very painful. So, I don't know if this helps at all, but I don't have a good clean-cut answer for you about that. Yes.
So when you say minds, I mean, I'm very familiar with the constant changing of visions of self. I can see myself as a great person, an idiot, you know, all those things constantly coming through. But it does seem like at some point something has to distill. You have to make some decisions as far as what self it is that's going to interact with other people, that's going to make decisions about how you do interact with other people, what you are going to do with your life. I mean, there is a certain level where you have to, well, you do have to go out in the world. You can't go in a monastery. How do you distill all these selves and lack of self into some coherent identity that you can go out in the world with?
One thing that strikes me is that may not be the right question. I don't know that that's not the right question, but I have a response to it, which is, I have a sense that, at least in my experience with this practice, is that over time, as I look at my motivations for doing things, they have moved. Rather continuously, away from concerning myself with whether myself is being rewarded by these activities as much as that whether my activities are motivated by love and compassion. And there's something in my own experience, there's something more satisfying about looking at my intentions from that point of view than whether I'm being taken care of from an ego standpoint. Now, my practice started when I was in my mid-40s, so that's a period of life where my professional life is already established, and I've moved into retirement for half the period of my practice. I've been retired from any wage-earning activities. So this might be a very easy thing for somebody at my stage of life to say what I just said to you. But my own experience looking back over the earlier part of my life when I didn't have this practice and I was making all of these decisions based on who I am and all that stuff, I never made any good decisions. The things that worked out well for me were things I didn't get to decide about. I realize in hindsight, the things that I got to make decisions about, I generally blew it. So I don't know what would have been the right criteria for me to have been using when I was younger, but I do know that the ones I was using didn't seem to be working. There was something in it that wasn't working. So I don't know how to frame that question or you know, how to frame the answer. But I do think, you know, when the teachings about karma in this area, this is all hindsight now because I didn't understand any of this stuff when I was making these kinds of decisions, but intention, it's everything's about intention in the karmic picture of things. So, and certainly my own experience, my inner life is a lot less afflicted when I've made the decisions from a point of view of metta and compassion than if I've made the decision based on getting what I need. Yes. One of my favorite things about Buddhism is the idea that you can come to deeper understanding through any of the doorways of the three characteristics, through seeing impermanence or dukkha or anatta, that any one of those doorways is equally gives you equal accessibility to awakening. And in the same way, my sense about this whole area of Buddha's teachings are that there's kind of no beginning and no end. You kind of circle around through all of these things, and you really can't get, I don't think, or at least I speak for myself now, the experiences of impermanence for me were a lot more immediate than to begin to really realize how insubstantial self was. I had so much invested in ego that it took me a long time to begin to admit to myself that I'd made this all up. And so, in some sense, and even now on these retreats where I'm talking about these experiences I'm telling you about, every retreat I go on, I have these experiences, there's no sudden awakening to the complete understanding of impermanence, at least for me, not so far. But it's more like a gradual, bit-by-bit awakening that comes through a little bit more understanding. I mean, not at the intellectual level, but something visceral happens when you really start to observe in the meditation process how fast everything is changing. You really kind of get it at a visceral level, a little bit more over a long period of time. That's at least been my experience. And so all of these things are coming to me in their turn, you know, gradually over time. And but one of the miraculous things to me about metta practice is you can actually be saying these phrases and not be able to genuinely feel them at some times, and yet you keep on saying them, and somehow you condition your mind so that the mind actually quite spontaneously and genuinely comes forth with this at a later time. That's mind-boggling to me, you know, that you can do that. But you can. Well, it's 10:45, and I understand that's the time that we have, so thank you very much.